What big what? Mayor Duncan had snorted.
The place up the dark canyon where they used to put the dead people.
What place? Johnny had taken out the bright bird badge and shown it to Mayor Duncan. Duncan had looked at it, twisting his head this way and that, twisting the badge this way and that. Parson Staffer, brighter in those days, had reached across the fire in a sudden swoop and grabbed the badge. The ensuing interrogation had not been pleasant, about young boys who went to places that were forbidden and got everybody in trouble and didn't listen at conferences where they had to learn legends and were too smart anyway. Mayor Duncan, however, had himself been curious and finally pinned Parson Staffer into recounting an applicable legend. A tomb of the old gods, the parson had finally said. Nobody has been there in living memory. Small boys do not count. But it was said to exist by my great-grandfather when he was still alive, and he lived a long time. The gods used to come into these mountains, and they buried the great men in huge caverns. When the lightning flashed on High Peak, it was because the gods had come to bury a great man from over the water. Once there were thousands and thousands living in big villages 100 times the size of this one. These villages were to the east, and it is said there is the remains of one straight east where thousands lived. And the place was flat except for some hills. And when a great man died there, the gods brought him to the tomb of the gods. Parson Staffer had shaken the badge. This was placed on the foreheads of the great when they were laid to rest in the great tomb of the gods. And that's what it is. And ancient law says that nobody is supposed to go there, and everybody had better stay away from there forever, especially little boys. And he had put the badge in his pouch, and that was the last Johnny ever saw of it. After all, Staffer was a holy man and in charge of holy things. Nevertheless, Johnny thought his father should have been buried in the tomb of the gods. Johnny had never been back there again, and thought of it only when he saw lightning hit High Peak. But he wished he had buried his father there.
"Are you worried?" asked Chrissy.
Johnny looked down at her, his reverie broken. The dying fire wove a reddish sheen into her hair and sparkled in her dark eyes.
"It's my fault," said Johnny.
Chrissy smiled and shook her head.
Nothing could be Johnny's fault.
"Yes, it is," said Johnny. "There's something wrong with this place. My father's bones. In the last year they just crumbled like that skeleton's in the tomb of the gods."
"The tomb of the what?" said Chrissy idly.
If Johnny wanted to talk nonsense, it was all right with her. At least he was talking to her.
"I should have buried him there. He was a great man. He taught me a lot of things. How to braid grass rope, how to wait for a puma to crouch before you stepped aside and hit him as he sprang. They can't turn in midair, you know. How to cut hide into strips."
"Johnny, you aren't guilty of anything."
"It was a bad funeral."
"Johnny, it's the only funeral I remember."
"No, it was not a good funeral. Staffer didn't preach a funeral sermon."
"He talked. I didn't listen because I was helping gather strawberries, but I know he talked. Did he say something bad?"
"No, only it didn't apply."
"Well, what did he say, Johnny?"
"Oh, you know, all that stuff about God being angry with the people. Everybody knows that legend. I can quote it myself."
"Quote it."
Johnny sniffed a little impatiently, but she was interested and it made him feel a little better.
"And then there came a day when God was wroth, and wearied he was of the fornicating and pleasure-dallying of the people. And he did cause a wondrous cloud to come, and everywhere it struck. The anger of God snuffed out the breath and breathing of 99 out of 100 men. And disaster lay upon the land, and plagues and epidemics rolled and smote the unholy. And when it was done, the wicked were gone, and only the holy and righteous, the true children of the Lord, remained upon the stark and bloodied field. But God even then was not sure, and so he tested them. He sent monsters upon them to drive them to the hills and secret places. And lo, the monsters hunted them and made them less and less until at last all men remaining were the only holy, the only blessed, the only sure righteous upon the earth. Hey, man.
Oh, that one. You say it very nicely, Johnny.
It's my fault, said Johnny morosely. I should have made my father listen. There is something wrong with this place. I'm certain that if he had listened and we moved elsewhere, he would be alive today. I feel it.
Where else is there?
There's that whole great plain out there. Weeks of riding on it, I am sure. And they say man once lived in a big village out there.
Oh, no, Johnny. The monsters.
I've never seen a monster.
You've seen the shiny flashing things that sail overhead every few days.
Oh, those. The sun and moon sail overhead, too. So do the stars, and even shooting stars.
Chrissy was frightened suddenly.
Johnny, you're not going to do something.
I am. With first light, I am going to ride out and see if there really was a big village in the plains.
Chrissy felt her heart contract. She looked up at his determined profile. It was as though she was sinking down, down into the earth, as though she lay in today's grave.
Please, Johnny.
No, I'm going.
Johnny, I'll go with you.
No, you stay here.
He thought fast, something to deter her.
I may be gone for a whole year.
Water got into her sight.
What will I do if you don't come back?
I'll come back.
Johnny, if you don't come back in a year, I'll come looking for you.
Johnny frowned. He scented blackmail.
Johnny, if you're leaving, you see those stars up there? When they come back to the same place next year and you haven't returned, I will come looking.
You'd be killed out in the plains. The pigs, the wild cattle.
Johnny, that is what I will do. I swear it, Johnny.
You think I'd just wander off and never return?
That's what I will do, Johnny. You can go, but that's what I will do.
5. The first dawn light was painting High Peak rose. It was going to be a beautiful day. Johnny Goodboy was completing the packing of a lead horse. Windsplitter was sidling about, biting at the grass but not really eating. He had his eye on Johnny. They were obviously going somewhere, and Windsplitter was not going to be left out. Some wisps of smoke were coming from the breakfast fire of the Jimson family nearby. They were roasting a dog. Yesterday at the funeral feast, nearly a score of dogs had gotten into an idiot fight. There had been plenty of bones and meat as well. But the pack had gotten into a fight, and a big brindle had been killed. Looked like the Jimson family would have meat all day. Johnny was trying to keep his mind on petty details, and off Chrissy and Patty, who were standing there watching him quietly. Brown Limper's staffer was also there, idling about in the background. He had a club foot and should have been killed at birth, but he was the only child the staffers had ever had, and Staffer was parson after all. Maybe mayor, too, since there wasn't any now. There was no affection whatever between Johnny and Brown Limper. During the funeral dancing, Brown had sat on the sidelines making sneering remarks about the dancing, about the funeral, about the meat, about the strawberries. But when he had made a remark about Johnny's father, maybe never had a bone in the right place, Johnny had hit him a backhand cuff. Made Johnny ashamed of himself, hitting a cripple. Brown Limper stood crookedly, a faint blue bruise on his cheek, watching Johnny get ready, wishes of bad luck written all over him. Two other boys of similar age, there were only 5 in the whole village who were in their late teens, wandered up and asked Brown what was going on. Brown shrugged. Johnny kept his mind carefully on his business. He was probably taking too much, but he didn't know what he'd run into. Nobody knew. In the 2 buckskin sacks he was roping on either side of the lead horse, he had flint stones for fire, rat's nests for tinder, bundles of cut thongs, some sharp-edged rocks that were sometimes hard to find and cut indifferently well, 3 spare kill clubs, 1 heavy enough to crush a bear's skull just in case, some warm robes that didn't stink very much, 1 couple of buckskins for spare clothes. He gave a start. He hadn't realized Chrissy had come within a foot of him. He hoped he wouldn't have to talk. Blackmail. That's what it was. Plain as possible and all bad. If she'd said she would kill herself if he didn't come back, well, one could have put that down to girl vaporings. But threatening to follow him in a year put another shadow on it entirely. It meant he would have to be cautious. He'd have to be careful not to get himself killed. It was one thing to worry about his own life. He didn't care a snap for risk or danger. But the thought of Chrissy going down on the plains if he didn't come back made him snow cold at the pit of his stomach. She'd be gored or mauled or eaten alive, and every agonizing second of it would be Johnny's fault. She had effectively committed him to caution and care, just what she intended. She was holding something out to him. Two somethings. One was a large bone needle with a thong hole in it, and the other was a skin awl. Both were worn and polished and valuable.
"They were Mama's," said Chrissy.
"I don't need anything."
"No, you have them."
"I won't need them."
"If you lose your clothes," she wailed, "how are you going to sew?"
The crowd had thickened. Johnny didn't need any outbursts. He snatched the needle and awl out of her hand and unlashed the neck of a sack and dropped them in, made sure they hadn't missed and dropped out, and then relashed the sack. Chrissy stood more quietly. Johnny turned and faced her. He was a little bit shocked. There wasn't even a smudge of color in her face. She looked like she hadn't slept and had tick fever as well. Johnny's resolution wavered. Then, beyond Chrissy, he saw a brown limper tittering and talking behind his hand to Petey Tomso. Johnny's face went tight. He grabbed Chrissy and kissed her hard. It was as though he had taken a board from an irrigation trough. The tears went down her cheeks. "Now look," said Johnny, "don't you follow me." She made a careful effort to control her voice.
"If you don't come back in a year, I will. By all the gods on High Peak, Johnny."
He looked at her. Then he beckoned to Windsplitter, who sidled over. With one smooth spring, he mounted, the lead rope of the other horse gripped in his hand. "You can have my other four horses," said Johnny to Chrissy. "Don't eat them, they're trained." He paused. "Unless you get awful hungry, of course, like in the winter." Chrissy hung on to his leg for a moment, and then she stepped back and sagged. Johnny thumped Windsplitter with a heel, and they moved off. This was going to be no wild, free ride to adventure. This was going to be a tiptoe scout with care. Chrissy had seen to that. At the entrance to the defile, he looked back. About 15 people were still standing there watching him go. They all looked dejected. He used a heel signal to make Windsplitter rear and waved his hand. They all waved back with sudden animation. Then Johnny was gone down the dark canyon trail to the wide and unknown plains. The rest of the people drifted off. Chrissy still stood there, hoping with a wild, crazy hope that he would ride into sight, returning. Patty tugged at her leg.
"Chrissy, Chrissy, will he come back?"
Chrissy's voice was very low, her eyes like ashes in a dead fire.
"Goodbye," she whispered.
6. Turl belched. It was a polite way to attract attention, but the belch didn't make much impression through the whine and howl of machines in the transport department maintenance dome. Zitz's concentration on his work became more marked. Mindsight 16's transport chief had little use for the security head. Every time a tool or a car or fuel turned up missing, or something was broken, it got attention from security. 3 crashed cars were strewn about in various stages of reassembly, one of them very messy with splotches of green cyclo blood in the interior upholstery. The big drills that dangled from the ceiling rails pointed sharp beaks this way and that, idling in their programming. Lathes with nothing in their jaws spun, waiting for something to twist and shave. Belts snarled and slapped at each other. Turl watched the surprisingly nimble talons of Zitt disassemble the small concentric shells of a high-speed jet engine. Turl had hoped to detect a small tremble or two in Zit's paws. If the transport chief's conscience was bothering him, it would be much easier to do business. There was no tremble. Zit finished the disassembly and threw the last string on the bench. His yellow orbs contracted as he looked at Turl.
Well, what have I done now?
Turl lumbered closer and looked around.
Where are your maintenance men?
We're 15 mechanics under complement. They were transferred to operations over the last month. I know it, and you know it. So why are you here? As chief of security, Turl had learned through experience not to be very straightforward. If he simply asked for a manual reconnaissance plane, the transport chief would demand the emergency voucher, not get it, and say, "No transport." And there were no emergencies for security on this dull planet, not real ones. In hundreds of years of operation, there had not been the slightest security threat to intergalactic mining operations here. A dull security scene, and consequently, the chief of that department was not considered very important. Apparent threats had to be manufactured with guile as their sole ingredient.
"I've been investigating a suspicion of conspiracy to sabotage transport," said Turl. "Kept me busy for the last 3 weeks."
He eased his bulk back against a wrecked car.
"Don't lean on that recon. You'll dent its wing."
Turl decided it was better to be friendly and rumbled over to a stool at the bench where Zt was working.
"Confidentially, Zt, I've had an idea that could get us some outside personnel. I'm working on it, and that's why I need a manual recon."
Zt batted his eye bones and sat down on another stool, which creaked despairingly under his 1,000-pound bulk.
"This planet," said Turl confidingly, "used to have a sentient race on it."
"What race was that?" asked Zt suspiciously.
"Man," said Turl.
Zt looked at him searchingly. A security officer was never noted for his sense of humor. Some had been known to bait and entrap and then file charges, but Zt couldn't help himself. His mouth bones started to stretch, and even though he sought to control them, they spread, and suddenly his laugh exploded in Turl's face. Zt hastily got it under control and turned back to his bench to resume work.
"Anything else on your mind?" asked Zt, as an afterthought.
This was not going well, thought Turl. Well, that's what happened when you were frank. It just didn't mix with security.
"This suspicion of conspiracy to sabotage transport,"
said Turl, as he looked around at the wrecked cars with half-lowered eye bones,
"could reach to high places."
Zt threw down a wrench with a clang. A low snarl rumbled in him. He sat there, staring in front of him. He was thinking.
"What do you really want?"
he asked at last.
"A recon plane. For 5 or 6 days.
Zt got up and yanked a transport schedule clipboard off the wall and studied it. He could hear Turl almost purring.
"You see this schedule?"
said Zt, pushing it under Turl's nose.
"Well, yes."
"Do you see where it has 6 drone recons assigned to security?"
"Of course."
"And do you see where this has been going on for?"
Zt peeled back sheet after sheet.
"Blast. For centuries, I suppose."
"Have to keep a mineside planet under surveillance,"
said Turl complacently.
"Under surveillance for what?" said Zt. "Every scrap of ore was spotted and estimated long before your and my living memory. There's nothing out there but mammals, air organisms."
"There might be a hostile landing."
"Here?" sneered Zt. "Company probes in outer space would detect it ages before it ever arrived here. Turl, transport has to fuel and maintain and recondition those drones 2 and 3 times a year. You know and I know the company is on an economy wave. Tell you what."
Turl waited sourly to be told.
If you will let us cancel those recon drones, I'll put a tri-wheel ground cycle at your disposal for a limited time.
Turl let out a small, shrill scream. Zt amended his bargain.
A ground car at your disposal when ordered.
Turl lumbered over to the crashed vehicle that had blood on its seats.
Wonder if this was caused by faulty maintenance.
Zt stood there, unrelenting. The crash had been caused by too much Kerbango on duty.
One recon drone programmed to cover the whole planet once a month, said Zt. One ground car at your permanent disposal.
Turl looked at the other wrecks, but couldn't think of anything. These investigations were done and dead. Teach him to close investigations. He wandered back to Zt.
One drone recon programmed to cover the whole planet once a month. One armored and firepower ground car at permanent disposal with no questions on ammunition, breathe gas, or fuel requisitions.
Zt took the forms from the bench drawer and made them out. He shoved the papers and clipboard at Turl. As he signed, Turl thought to himself that this transport chief really ought to be looked into, maybe for ore robbery.
Zt took the papers back and removed from the switchboard the combination key card of the oldest and rattiest ground car that was gathering dust in the garage dome. He coupled it with a coupon book for ammo, another for breathe gas, and another for fuel. The deal would never actually become part of recorded history as a deal, for the dates of the orders were carefully not coincident. Neither suspected that they had just materially altered the future of the planet, and not for the better of Intergalactic. But that is sometimes the way with large commercial companies.
When Turl had left to get his Mark II armored firepower ground car, Zt thought to himself that it was wonderful what lies executives told just to be able to go hunting. Kill mad they all were. Machine kill mad, too, from the jam-ups he had to repair. What a story. Man, a sentient race indeed. He laughed and got back to work.
7.
Johnny Goodboy Tyler galloped free across the vast ocean of grass, Windsplitter exuberantly stretching his legs, the lead horse rollicking along behind. What a day. Blue sky and the wind a cooling freshness on his face. Now, 2 days out, he had come down from the mountains, through the foothills, and into the vastest plain he had ever imagined. He could still see the tiniest tip of High Peak behind him, and with the sun it kept him true on course and reassured him that he could find his way home whenever he wanted. Total security. The herds of wild cattle were many, but he had been living with those all his life. A few wolves, but what were wolves? No bear, no puma so far. Why, in all reverence to the gods, did anybody ever stay cooped up in the mountains? And monsters. What monsters? Pah! Crazy tales. Even that shiny floating cylinder that had gone overhead every few days the whole of his life was overdue down here. It had come from west to east with the regularity of every other heavenly body, but even it seemed to have stopped. On his present course, he would have seen it. In short, Johnny Goodboy Tyler was suffering from a bad case of overconfidence, and the first disaster that hit him had to do with pigs. Pigs were usually easy to kill, if you were a bit nimble and watched out for charges of the boars. And a small suckling pig was exactly what one could use for dinner. Right there ahead of him, clear in the afternoon light, was a compact herd of pigs out in the open. There were big ones and small ones, but they were all fat. Johnny pulled Windsplitter to a halt and slid off. The wind was not quite right, a bit too downwind to the pigs. They'd smell him if he approached directly. With a bent-knee run, he brought himself silently around them until the wind was at right angles. He stopped and hefted his club. The tall grass was nearly to his waist. The pigs were rooting around a shallow depression in the plain, where waters stood in the wet months, making a temporary marsh. There must be roots to be had there, Johnny supposed. There were dozens of pigs, every one with his snout down. With a crouching gait, staying below the grass tops, Johnny went forward, closing the distance yard by yard. Only a few feet separated him now from the outermost fringe of pigs. Silently, he rose until his eyes were just above the level of the grass. A small porker was only 3 arm spans from him, an easy throw. "Here's for supper," breathed Johnny, and heaved his kill club straight and true at the head of the pig. Dead on, a direct hit. The pig let out an ear splitter and dropped. But that wasn't all that happened. Instant confusion roared. Hidden from Johnny by the tall grass and slightly behind him and to his right, a 500-pound boar who had become tired of eating had lain down for a nap. The squeal of the hit pig acted like a whip on the whole herd, and away they went in an instant charge, straight upwind at Johnny's horses. For the big boar, to see was to charge. Johnny felt like he had been struck by a mountain avalanche. He was knocked flat and squashed, in instants so close together they felt like one. He rolled, but the whole sky over him was filled with boar belly. He didn't see, but he sensed the teeth and tusks trying to find him. He rolled again, the savage squeals mixing with the roaring pound of the blood in his ears. Once more he rolled, and this time he saw daylight and a back. In the blink of an eye, he was on the boar's back. He reached an arm across the throat. The boar spun around and around like a bucking horse. Johnny's arm tightened until he could feel his sinews crack, and then the boar, strangled, dropped into a limp, jerking pile. Johnny unloaded quickly and backed up. The boar was gasping its breath back. It lurched to unsteady feet, and seeing no opponent, staggered off. Johnny went over and picked up the small pig, keeping an eye on the departing boar. But the boar, although it cast about and made small, convulsive charges, still couldn't see anybody, and after a bit it trotted in the direction the herd had taken, following the trampled grass. There was no herd in sight. And there were no horses. No horses. Johnny stood there with the dead pig. He had no sharp rock to cut it. He had no flints to start a fire and roast it. And he had no horses. It might be worse. He looked at his legs, expecting to see tusk gashes, but he found none. His back and face ached a bit from the collision of the charge and his own collision with the ground, but that was all. Mentally kicking himself, more ashamed than scared, he made off in the direction of the trail of crushed grass. After a while, his depression wore off a bit, to be replaced by optimism. He began to whistle a call. The horses would not have just gone on running in front of the pigs. They would have veered off somewhere. Just as darkness was falling, he spotted Windsplitter calmly cropping grass. The horse looked up with a, "Where have you been?" and then, with a plainly mischievous grin, as though he had intended to all the time, came over and bumped Johnny with his muzzle. It took another 10 minutes of anxious casting about to locate the lead horse in the packs. Johnny went back a short way to a little spring they'd passed and made camp. There he made himself a belt and a pouch, and into the latter he put tinder and a flint and some small sharp-edged stones. He put a stronger thong on the big kill club and fastened it to the belt. He wasn't going to be caught empty-handed a second time in this vast prairie, no indeed. That night he dreamed of Chrissy being strangled by pigs, Chrissy mauled by bears, Chrissy crushed to a pulp under stampeding hoofs, while he stood helpless in the sky where the spirits go, unable to do a damned thing. 8. The great village where thousands had lived was obviously another one of those myths, like monsters. But he would look for it nonetheless. By the half-light of the yellowing dawn, Johnny was again trotting eastward. The plain was changing.
There were some features about it that didn't seem usual, such as those mounds. Johnny detoured from his way into the sun to look at one of them. He stopped, leaning forward with a hand braced on Windsplitter's shoulder to study the place. It was a little sort of hill, but it had a hole in the side, a rectangular hole. Otherwise, the mound was all covered with dirt and grass. Some freak of nature? A window opening? He slid off his horse and approached it. He walked around it. Then he paced it out. It was about 35 paces long and 10 paces wide. Ha! Maybe the mound was rectangular, too. An old splintered stump stood to one side, and Johnny appropriated a jagged piece of it. He approached the window and, using the scrap of wood, began to push away the grass edges. It surprised him that he seemed to be digging not in earth, but in loose sand. When he got the lower part of the rectangle cleared, he could get right up to it and look into it. The mound was hollow. He backed up and looked at his horses and then around at the countryside. There wasn't anything menacing there. He bent over and started to crawl into the mound. And the window bit him. He straightened right up and looked at his wrist. It was bleeding. It wasn't a bad cut. It was that he was cut at all that startled him. Very carefully he looked at the window. It had teeth. Well, maybe they weren't teeth. They were dull bright and had a lot of colors in them, and they stood all around the outside edges of the frame. He pulled one of them out. They were very loose. He took a bit of thong from his belt and tried it. Wonder of wonders. The tooth readily cut the thong, far better than the best rock edge. Hey, he thought, delighted, look what I got. And with the greatest care, for the things did bite unless you were careful, he removed the splinters, big and small, from the frame and stacked them neatly. He went to his pack and got a piece of buckskin and wrapped them up. Valuable. You could cut and skin and scrape something wonderful with these things. Some kind of rock. Or this mound was the skull of some strange beast, and these were the remains of its teeth. Wonderful. When he had them all and they were carefully stowed in his pack, except one nice bit he put in his belt pouch, he returned to the task of entering the mound. There was nothing to bite him now, and he climbed through the rectangle. There wasn't any pit. The level of the inside seemed to be a bit higher than the outside ground. A sudden flurry startled him half out of his wits, but it was just a bird that had a nest in here, and it left through the window with a rustle of wings. Once outside, it found a place to sit and began to scold and scold. Johnny fumbled his way through the dimness. There wasn't much there, mainly rust, but there had been things here. He could tell from the rust piles and wall marks. Walls? Yes, the place had walls. They were of some sort of rough stone or something, very evenly fitted together in big square blocks. Yes, these were walls. No animal made anything like this. And no animal made anything like this tray. It must have been part of something else, now turned to reddish powder. At the bottom of the powder were some circular discs about as big as three thumbnails. And at the bottom of the pile of discs was one that was almost bright. Johnny picked it up and turned it over. He caught his breath. He moved over to the window where there was better light. There could be no mistake. It was the big bird with spread wings and arrows gripped in its claws. The same sign he had found in the tomb. He stood in quivering excitement for a bit, and then calmed down. He had it now. The mystery was solved. And he went back out the window and showed Windsplitter. Godhouse, said Johnny. This is where they stayed while waiting to take great men up to the tomb. Pretty, isn't it? Windsplitter finished chewing a mouthful of grass and gave Johnny a shove in the chest. It was time they were going. Johnny put the disc in his belt pouch. Well, it was no great village, but it proved definitely that there were things to find out here in the plains. Walls. Imagine that. Those gods could build walls. The bird stopped scolding in some relief as Johnny mounted up and moved away.
It looked after the little cavalcade and then, with a couple more criticisms, went back inside the ancient ruin. 9. Turl was as happy as a baby cyclo on a diet of straight curbango. Although it was late in the day, he was on his way. He steered the Mark II ground car down the ramp, through the atmosphere port, and into the open air. There was a warning plaque on the ledge in front of the driver's seat. Battle readiness must be observed at all times. Although this tank is compression-contained, personal face masks and independent breathing systems must be kept in place. Personal and unauthorized battle use prohibited. Signed, Political Department, Intergalactic Mining Company, Vice Director Zott. Turl grinned at the sign. In the absence of political officers, on a planet where there were no indigenous politics, and in the absence of a war department, on a planet that had nothing to war against, the chief of security covered both those functions. That this old battle car existed on the planet at all meant that it must be very, very old, and in addition must have gotten there as a result of fixed allocations of vehicles to company stations. Clerks in Planet One, Galaxy One offices were not always well advised when they wrote their endless directives and orders to the far-flung outposts of the commercial empire. Turl threw his personal face mask and tank onto the gunner's seat beside him and rubbed a thankful paw over his craggy face. What a lark! The old car ran like a well-greased digger. Small, not more than 30 feet long and 10 feet high, it skimmed above the ground like a low-flying wingless bird. Cunning mathematics had contoured it so that every exterior surface would make a hostile projectile glance off at an angle. Missile-proof glass slots gave a fine view of the terrain. Even the blast muzzles of its artillery were cleverly recessed. The interior upholstery, though worn and cracked in places, was a beautiful, soothing shade of purple. Turl felt good. He had 5 days of jet fuel and breathe gas, and 5 days of rations in their 10-pound packs. He had cleaned up every scrap of paper in his baskets and had started no new emergencies. He had a borrowed shaft analysis picto recorder that would take great pictures when put to other uses. And he was on his way. A break in the dull life of a security chief on a planet without insecurities. A planet that wasn't likely to produce many opportunities for an ambitious security chief to get promotion and advancement. It had been a gut blow when they ordered him to Earth. He wondered at once what he had done, whom he had accidentally insulted, whose bad side he had gotten on. But they assured him that none of these was the case. He was young. A cyclo had a lifespan of about 190 years, and Turl had been only 39 when he had been appointed. It was pointed out to him that few ever became security chiefs at such a tender age. It would show in his record that he had been one. And when he came back from the duty tour, they would see. Plums, like planets you could breathe on, went to older cyclos. He had not been fooled, really. Nobody in Security Personnel Pool Planet One, Galaxy One, had wanted anything at all to do with this post. He could hear the future assignment interview now. Last post? Earth. Where? Earth. Rimstar. Third planet, secondary galaxy 16. Oh, what did you accomplish on that post? It's all in the record. Yes, but there's nothing in the record. There must be something. Let me see it. No, no, confidential company record. And then the final horror. Employee Turl, it just happens that we have an opening in another Rim Star system, galaxy 32. It's a quiet place, no indigenous life, and no atmosphere at all. Or even worse. Employee Turl, Intergalactic has been dropping for some time on the exchange, and we have orders to economize. I'm afraid your record doesn't recommend continued employment. Don't call us, we'll call you. He already had a bit of scribble on the wall. A month ago, he'd received word that his tour of duty had been extended, and there was no mention of his relief. A little bit of horror had touched him, a vision of a 190-year-old Turl tottering around on this same planet, long forgotten by friends and family, ending his days in a dome-crazy stupor, lowered into a slit-trench grave, and ticked off the roster by a clerk who kept the records neat, but didn't know a single face on them. Such questionable fates required action. Big action. There were better daydreams. Waiting in a big entrance hall, uniformed ushers at attention, but one of them whispering to another, "Who's that?" And the other, "Don't you know? That's Turl." And the big doors opening. "The president of the company is waiting to thank you, sir. Please come this way." According to the mine surveys, there was an ancient highway to the north of here. Turl flipped the ground car onto auto and spread out a big map. There it was, running east and west. And west was where he wanted to go. It would be busted up and overgrown, maybe even hard to spot. But it would have no steep grades, and it would run squarely up into the mountains. Turl had drawn a big circle around the target meadow. There was the highway ahead. He threw the controls to manual and fumbled a bit. He hadn't driven one of these things since security school years ago, and his uncertain control made the car yaw. He zoomed up the side embankment of the road and yanked back the throttles and pawed the brakes. The car slammed to earth in a geysering puff of dust, square in the center of the highway. It was a pretty jolting stop, but not bad, not bad. He'd get better at it. He picked up his face mask and tank and donned them. Then he hit the decompression button so the tanks would recontain the breathe gas without waste. There was a momentary vacuum, a trifle uncomfortable on the hearing bones, and then with a sigh the outside air entered the cab. Turl swung open the top hatch and stood up on the seat, the tank creaking and shuddering under his repositioned weight. The wind felt cool outside the borders of his face mask. He gazed around with some distaste. This sure was wide country, and empty. The only sound was the whisper of wind in the grass, and the sound of silence, vast silence. Even a far-off bird call made the silence heavier. The earth was tan and brown. The grass and occasional shrubs were green. The sky was an expansive blue, speckled with white puffs of clouds. A strange country. People on home planet wouldn't believe it. No purple anywhere. With a sudden inspiration, Turl reached down into the car and grabbed the picto recorder. He aimed it in a sweeping circle, letting it grind away. He'd send his folks a spool of this. Then they'd believe him when he said it was one horns awful of a planet and maybe sympathize with him. "My daily view," he said into the recorder as he finished the sweep. The words rumbled through his mask, sounding sad. There was something purple. Straight west, there were some mountains, and they looked purple. He put the picto recorder down and grinned at the mountains, so far away. This was better than he thought. No wonder men lived up in the mountains. They were purple. Maybe the men were a bit sentient after all. He hoped so, but not with any great confidence. He was probably optimistic, but it gave some substance to his nebulous plans. Still looking westward, he suddenly caught sight of a landscape feature between himself and the mountains. A distant skyline silhouetted against the declining sun. He shifted a lever on his face mask glass to get magnification. The skyline leaped closer. Yes, he was right. There was a ruined city. Fuzzy and broken, but the buildings still very tall, and quite extensive. The wind fluttered his mind map as he looked at it. The ancient highway ran straight west into it. Reaching down, he took a massive tome off the pile he had on the rear crew seat and opened it to a marked place. There was an insert drawing on the page. Some cultural artist had sketched it a few centuries ago. The company had used air-breathing chinkos for cultural posts on planets where there was air. The Chinkos had come from Galaxy 2, beings as tall as Cyclos, but thread-thin and delicate. They were an old race, and the Cyclos didn't like to admit they had learned what they knew of cultural arts from them. But they had been easy to transport, despite breathing air and being feather-light, and they were cheap. Alas, they were no more, not even in Galaxy 2, having initiated a strike of all things. Intergalactic had wiped them out, but that was long after the culture and ethnology department had been terminated on Earth. Turl had never seen a Chinko. Remarkable beings, drawing pictures like this. Colorful, too. Why would anybody draw something? He compared the distant skyline to the sketch. Aside from a bit of blunting and crumbling in the ensuing years, they were the same. The text said, "To eastward of the mountains lies the ruin of a man-city remarkably well-preserved. It was man-called Denver. It is not as aesthetically advanced as those in the middle or eastern part of the continent. The usual miniature doors have little or no ornamentation. The interiors are no more than slightly oversized dollhouses. Utility rather than artistry seems to have been the overall architectural purpose. There are three cathedrals, which were apparently devoted to the worship of different heathen gods, showing that the culture was not monosectarian, even though it may have been dominated by priesthoods. One god, Bank, seems to have been more general in worship. There was a man library remarkably well stocked with books. The department sealed some of the library rooms after removing to archives the only important volumes, those on mining. As no ore bodies were evident under the foundations and no valuable ore materials were employed by the indigenous population in its construction, the Man City remains in a remarkable state of preservation, aided in part by the dry climate. The cost of further restoration is being requisitioned." Turl laughed to himself. No wonder the Culture and Ethnology Department had been phased out on this planet, if it was applying for credits to reconstruct manned cities. He could hear the counterblast from the directors now. They'd fair put a shaft through the heads of such arty types. Well, it was data he might use in his plans. Who knew? He got back to the business at hand. There was the highway stretching out. He was right in the middle of it. It was a couple of hundred feet wide at this point, and it could be clearly discerned. It probably had 2 or 3 feet of sand on top of it, but the growing grass was uniform and the shrubs to either side, not being able to put down roots directly on it, defined between their 2 edge rows a straight course. Turl took another look around. There were some cattle, a small herd of horses in the distance. Nothing worth shooting, since no cyclo could eat meat of that metabolism. Nothing dangerous enough to offer sport. It was luxurious to have time to think about hunting, and even to be equipped for it, and even more luxurious not to do it. He had a bigger game going anyway. He dropped down into the driver's seat and punched the buttons to close the top. The unbreathable air exhausted from the cab and was replaced by proper gas. He took off his face mask, contrary to regulations, and dropped it on the gunner's seat. The purple interior was a relief to his nerves. This confounded planet, it even looked bad through the purple tint of the windscreens. He glanced again at the map. Now was the time for some luck. He knew he couldn't go up into the mountains themselves due to the uranium the recon drones always indicated in that area. But the recon drones also reported that these man-things sometimes came down to the mountain foothills, which were safe enough. Turl thought over his plans again. They were beautiful plans. Personal wealth, personal power. The recon drones had told him more than others knew. The scans had pointed out a vein of almost solid gold, uncovered by a landslide after intergalactic surveys were finalized. A delicious, fabulously rich vein of gold in plain sight, a vein about which the company was ignorant, since the landslide was recent and Turl had destroyed the records. A joke on Zt to propose no more recon drones over the area. The uranium count in that area of the mountains was formidable, and so no cyclo could mine it. Even a few bits of uranium dust could explode cyclo breathe gas. Turl smiled at his own genius. All he needed was a man-thing, and then a few more man-things. They could mine it, and to blast with uranium. Somehow he would get the gold off the planet and home, and he had ideas about how he could do that, too. Then, wealth and power, and no more of this place. All the security chief had to do was keep others from suspecting what he was really doing, to advertise quite other reasons. But Turl was an expert at that. If he were truly lucky, he could catch a man-thing this side of the meadow. He did not have too much time to lie in wait. He felt lucky. The sun was very low, thanks to his late start. He'd lie up in that man's city for the night, sleeping in the car. He sent the Mark II skimming along the ancient highway. 10. A skyline. Johnny Good Boy Tyler pulled up with a yank so sudden he startled Windsplitter into a rear. There it was, straight east. It wasn't hills or mountains. It wasn't some trick of the eye. It was sharp and rectangular. He had been so unconvinced. When he had left the ancient ruin, he found a very easy way to travel. It was almost as if the ruin with the window had once had a broad path leading to it. There were shrubs on the right and shrubs on the left, two rows about 200 feet apart that dwindled eastward into the distance. Underfoot, there was fairly even grass. You had to watch it a bit because there were shallow gullies in places. When you looked down between these little gullies, there was something gray-white. Johnny had inspected it with care. He had gotten down and dug at the edges of such a crack, and it seemed that the gray-white stuff was continuous, just like the inner walls of the ruin. Maybe it was a wall of the ancients fallen over sideways. But no, it would have cracked as it fell. Outside the house at home, level stones had been laid as pavement. But who wanted a pavement 200 feet wide, and hours' journey long? For what? This big path had not been used for a long time, if it was a path. It went between hillocks that had been sliced into, and it went across watercourses, although it was pretty irregular and broken in these. He had been excited for a while, but then he got used to it and devoted his attention mainly to keeping Windsplitter from tripping in the little gullies. When he was a little boy, one of the families had had a wheeled cart they hauled firewood in, and he had been told that once there had been a lot of carts, even one that was pulled by a mare. Well, you could sure roll a cart on this wide turf, and roll it fast and far. But as to the great village, he was coming to believe, as the afternoon wore on, that somebody had probably seen that godhouse back there and multiplied it in his imagination. And then suddenly, there it was. But was it? He put Windsplitter up to a trot, regardless of the little gullies. In the clear air, the skyline wasn't coming his way very fast. It even appeared to be receding. He stopped. Maybe it was a trick of the eye after all. But no, the lines it made were up and down and flat on top, and there was an awful lot of it. It wasn't hills or mountains. Only building sides could be that regular. He started up again, more sedately, remembering now to be careful, and after a while, he could see that he was getting closer. The sun was coming down, and he wasn't there yet. The prospect of entering that place in the dark was definitely not cheering. Who knew what it might be full of? Ghosts? Gods? People? Monsters? Ah, no, not monsters. They were just the stuff mamas frightened their kids to sleep with. He pulled off the path where it crossed a stream and made camp. He warmed up some of his roasted pork and then cut it with one of the sharp, shiny things he had taken out of the window. My, he marveled, imagine anything cutting like that. It would make life a real pleasure. You had to watch it not to cut your own fingers, as he had already done twice, slightly. Maybe you could bed the cutting edge in wood or something for a handle. Then you would really have something. After supper, he built up his fire to keep the wolves off. A couple were sitting over there now, amber-eyed in the reflected firelight and looking hungry. "Run away," shouted Johnny, "or I'll be wearing your hides." But the wolves just sat there. Windsplitter and the lead horse didn't want to go away from the fire. The wolves made them nervous. So Johnny picked up a couple of rocks, fist-sized, from the nearby stream bed. He wasn't interested in hunting wolves, but his horses had to find grass. He threw a pork bone about 10 feet beyond the fire and in the direction of the wolves. Big, rangy things they were. One slunk forward, belly low, snarling, to reach the pork bone. In a moment, the wolf's attention would be fixed on the bone. Johnny's arm blurred. The far wolf caught the rock squarely between his eyes. Johnny's arm blurred again. The near wolf didn't jump in time, and he, too, was a dead wolf. Johnny said to Windsplitter, "I got to do all the work. Is that it?" And he walked over to the far wolf and hauled the carcass to the fire. Then he dragged the closer one in. Nope. Neither one had a pelt worth taking at this time of the year. And they had ticks, too. "Go on and eat," he told the horses. He built up the fire again, just in case the wolves had friends, and rolled up his robes. Tomorrow was going to be the day. 11. Johnny approached the great village cautiously. He was up before first light, and the yellow dawn found him in the outskirts of the place, peering, halting, looking closer at the strange sights, nervous. Sand lay over everything, and grass and even scrub grew in the wide paths between the buildings. He gave a start every time a rabbit or a rat came tearing out of the ancient structures, disturbed by his footfalls. Even though the hoofs were muffled by the grass and sand, the silence of the place was so intense that any disturbance of it seemed overloud. He had never heard an echo before to notice it. The return of sound caused him a great deal of worry. For a little while, he thought there must be another horse walking in the distance, but at last he worked it out. He hit his wrist kill club against the one in his belt and promptly heard the same sound repeated softly like a mockery. He waited, but no further mock occurred. Then he hit the clubs together again, and the same sound returned. He decided it didn't happen unless he did it first. He looked about him. To both his left and his right were the tall remains of buildings, very tall indeed. Pitted by wind erosion, discolored by endless centuries of weather, they still stood, flat and even and imposing. Astonishing. Whoever could build such things? Gods, perhaps? He eyed the massive size of the building blocks. No man could lift one by himself. Johnny sat his horse in the middle of what must have been the main path of the great village. He frowned, straining to comprehend the building of such a place. Many men? But how could they reach so high? He concentrated laboriously. Gradually, he could conceive that if one built up steps of logs, and if many, many men put ropes around a block, and if they carried it up the steps and then took the steps away, they might have done it. Marvelous, dizzy, and dangerous. But it was possible. Satisfied that it didn't need gods or monsters to have made this place, and therefore very relieved, he continued his exploration. He wondered whether some odd kind of tree had grown along this path. He got down and looked at the stump of one. It was hard and jagged. It had been hollow, and it was deep in the strange rock. It wasn't wood. It was a reddish metal, and when you scraped away the red powder, underneath was black. He looked up and down both sides of the wide path. The placing of these things was very precise. Although he couldn't figure out what they were for, it was obvious that, like buildings, they were placed objects. The innumerable windows surrounded him, seeming to stare back at him. The morning sun had come now, and it shone into those that faced it. Here and there were vast surfaces of the shiny stuff he had collected from the mound on the plain.
It was not clear. It was whitish and bluish, like the cataracts on an old man's eyes. But there were whole sheets of it in some places. He began to realize it was some kind of covering, perhaps to keep out the cold.